Kathleen. When I said nothing, he continued, I still remember that night, every minute of it. And I know what it meant. My head jerked up. Don't talk about that night, I snapped. Is that why you won't marry me? Is it because you feel guilty? Geez, Kate, it was one night 20 years ago. Loads of husbands have behaved worse. It was one night. One night we agreed wouldn't be repeated. I shook my head. And we didn't, did we? I was a good husband to Jean, and you know it. Oh, I knew it. I'd spent more than half my life thinking about it. Then why? Jean told me, Jesus, with her dying words, she told me that she wanted me to be happy. She as good as told me that we should be together. What the hell is stopping us? What the hell is stopping you? I had to get up to leave. I shook my hand at him, the other pressed over my mouth, as I made my way unsteadily towards my car. I couldn't tell him. I couldn't tell him the truth. That what Jean had told him was a message, all right, but it was a message for me. She was telling me through him that she'd known. That for all those years afterwards, she'd known. And that woman understood that knowing this would fill me with guilt for the rest of my days. Jean Gaines had known both of us better than Nino thought. That night I didn't go out to the cruise. Guessing correctly that their indignation would fuel a long evening, I let Liza serve them and pleaded a headache. Then I sat in my little office at the back of the kitchen where I worked out the guest accounts, and stared at the years of ledgers, the accounts that charted the hotel's history. The years from 1946 to 1960 were fat binders, telling in the width of their spines the hotel's popularity. Occasionally I would open them and look at the parchment-like bills for sides of beef, imported brandy and cigars, evidence of celebrations for a good day's catch. My father had kept every last receipt, a habit I have carried with me. That was when the seas were full, the lounge area was loud with laughter, and our lives were simple. Our chief concern to celebrate the end of war and our new prosperity afterwards. The spine of last year's book was less than half an inch wide. I ran my hand along the row of leather-bound volumes, letting my fingertips register by touch the diminishing widths. Then I looked up at the photograph of my mother and father, solemn in their wedding clothes as they stared down at me. I wondered what they would have thought of my predicament. Nino had told me I could probably sell this place to the hotel people, that, given the right negotiator, I could argue the price up. Maybe get enough to start somewhere new, but I was too old for house hunting, too old to cram what remained of my life into a boxy little bungalow. I didn't want to have to find my way round new medical centres and supermarkets, make polite conversation with new neighbours. My life was in these walls, these books. Everything that had ever meant anything to me stood in this place. As I gazed at those books, I realised I needed this house more than I had admitted. I'm not a drinker, but that night I reached into the drawer of my father's desk, opened his old silver hip flask, and allowed myself a tot of whiskey. It was almost 10:15 when Liza knocked on the door. "How's your head?" she said, closing it behind her. "Fine." I closed the accounts book, hoping I looked as if I'd been working. It didn't hurt, but I did. Everything about me felt weary. "Mike Dormer has just walked in and gone straight upstairs. He acted like he's not going anywhere. I thought you should probably have a word."
"I said he could stay," I told her quietly, rising from my seat to place the book back on the shelf.
You did what?
You heard.
But why? We don't want him anywhere near us.
I didn't look at her. I didn't need to. I could tell from her appalled tone that her face would be pink with anger. He's paid up to the end of the month.
So give him his money back.
You think I can throw that sort of money away? I snapped at her. I'm charging him three times as much as anyone else.
The money's not the issue, Kathleen.
Yes, it is, Liza. The money is the issue. Because we're going to need every last penny. And that means every last guest who wants to stay here is going to get a welcome from me, even if it makes my darn blood curdle to do it. She was shocked.
But think of what he's done, she said.
$250 a night, Liza, that's what I'm thinking. More for the girlfriend's meals. You tell me how else we're going to make that kind of money.
The whale crews. They're out there every night.
How much money do you think I make off them? A couple of cents per bottle of beer? A dollar or so per meal? You really think I could charge proper money when I know half of them are living on free biscuits? For goodness sake, haven't you noticed that half the time Yoshi doesn't have the money to pay us at all? But he's going to destroy us. And you're going to let him sit up there in your best room while it happens. What's done is done, Liza. Whether that hotel goes ahead or not is out of our hands. All we need to think about is making the most of our income while we still have one.
And bugger the principals?
We can't afford principals, Liza, and that's the truth. Not if we want to keep Hannah in school shoes. I knew what she was really saying. What neither of us could bear to say out loud. How could I willingly harbour the man who had broken what remained of her heart? How could I put her through the ache of having to watch him and that girl float around her home, flaunting their relationship? We glared at each other. I felt breathless and put out a hand to steady myself. Her lips were tight with hurt and indignation.
You know what, Kathleen? I really don't understand you sometimes.
Well, you don't have to understand, I said curtly, making as if to tidy my desk. You just get on with your business and let me run my hotel. I don't think we'd had a cross word in the 5 years she had lived here, and I could tell it had shaken us both. I felt that hip flask calling to me, but I wouldn't take it out in front of her. I didn't want her to take an example from me and get drunk herself, in case it led to another catastrophic encounter with Greg. In the end, she turned sharply and left, bristling, without a word. I bit my tongue. I couldn't tell her the truth behind my decision because I knew she'd disagree. She'd react badly even to the merest suggestion of what I suspected to be true, because it wasn't just about money. It was because I understood, more than anyone realized, how that young man had got into the situation he had. More importantly, it was about bait. And despite everything that had happened, my gut told me that keeping Mike Dormer close to us was going to be our best chance of survival.
14. Mike. The dog walkers had stopped waving to me. The first morning I ran past them, I assumed they hadn't seen me. Perhaps my woolen hat was pulled too far down over my face. I got used to our little morning exchanges and had found myself looking out for familiar faces. But on the second morning, when I lifted my hand in greeting and they turned away their faces, I realized that not only was I no longer anonymous, but in parts of Silver Bay, I was now public enemy number one. The same was true at the local garage, when I pulled in for fuel, at the supermarket checkout, and in the little seafood cafe by the jetty when I sat down and tried to order coffee. It took nearly 40 minutes and several reminders to arrive at my table. Vanessa was bullish. "Oh, you're always going to ruffle a few feathers," she said dismissively. "Remember that school development in East London? The people in the flats opposite were funny about it until they discovered how much it would push up the value of their properties." But that had been different, I wanted to say to her. I didn't care what those people thought of me. And besides, Vanessa wasn't having to confront Liza, who managed to behave both as if I were no longer in existence and treat me with a kind of icy resentment. On the one occasion I had found her alone in the kitchen, Vanessa had been upstairs, I had said, I've told your aunt. I'm going to try and stop it. I'm sorry. The look she gave me stopped me in my tracks. Sorry about what, Mike? That you've been living here under false pretenses? That you're about to ruin us? Or that you're a duplicitous shit? You told me you didn't want a relationship. You didn't tell me you were already in one. As soon as she said this, her expression closed, as if she felt she had given too much away. But I knew what she had felt. I had rerun that moment in the car as if it were on a spool tape inside my head. I could have recited word for word what we had said to each other. Then I was reminded of my own duplicity on so many levels, and at that point I usually rang Dennis or found some administrative task to do with the development. That's the beauty of business. It's a refuge of myriad practical problems. You always know where you stand with it. I told Vanessa why I thought the development was no longer right as the plan stood. She didn't believe me, so I took her out on Moby One with several tourists and showed her the dolphins. Yoshi and Lance were courteous, but I felt an almost physical discomfort at the lack of good-humoured conversation, and I missed Lance's caustic insults. I was no longer one of them. I knew it, and so did they. That sense of silent disapproval followed me around the bay, until I was convinced that even the Korean tourists on the top deck knew what I was responsible for. I might as well stick a harpoon in my hand and label myself whale killer, I said, when the silence became too much. Vanessa told me I was being oversensitive. Why should you care what they think? She said. In a few days you'll never have to see any of them again. I care because I want to get this right, I said, and I think we can get it right, ethically and commercially. I knew it was vital to have Vanessa on side if we were to convince Dennis to alter the plans. Ethical business, eh? She raised an eyebrow, but she didn't write it off as an idea. Then, as if in answer to my prayers, the seas opened. Yoshi's voice came over the PA system, lifted with excitement as it always was in the presence of a whale. Ladies and gentlemen, she said, if you look out of your portside windows, that's left for those who don't know, you can just make out a humpback. She might be headed toward us, so we're going to turn off the engines and hope she comes close. There was a swell of excited chatter on the top deck. I pulled my scarf up round my face and pointed to where I'd caught sight of a blow. I watched Vanessa's face, knowing that this moment might be crucial, praying that the whale would know what was good for it and impress her. Then, as if on cue, it breached not 40 feet away from us, its huge prehistoric head turning as it splashed back into the water. Like me, she couldn't help gasping, and her face softened with a childlike joy. For a moment, I saw in her the girl I had loved before I had come here. I took her hand and squeezed it. She squeezed mine back. You see what I mean? I said. You see how this is impossible? But the planning's going through, she said, when she could tear her gaze away. You made it. I can't live with myself, I said. I've seen what can happen, and I don't want to feel responsible for spoiling something here. We stood and watched as the whale breached again, further away this time, then disappeared under the waves, no longer diverted by curiosity, compelled to continue its journey north. The tourists around us hung over the rails, hoping it might re-emerge, then drifted back to the plastic chairs and benches, chattering and comparing images on their cameras. I thought of Lance, below us in the cockpit, breathing a sigh of relief at another whale-watching trip successfully completed. Perhaps he and Yoshi would be discussing the animals' movements, chatting on the radio to the other boats as they worked out where to go next. If Vanessa gets it, I thought, we have a chance of making this thing work. I stood and let my eyes run 360 degrees around me, taking in the distant coastline, the series of small, uninhabited islands that stood like sentries to the greater expanse of land. Above us, birds swooped and dived, and I tried to remember what the crews had previously told me. Ospreys, gannets, white-breasted sea eagles. Around us, the sea rose and fell, glinting on one side, darker and apparently less amenable on the other. I no longer felt alien out here. Despite their lack of money, their insecure lifestyle and their diet of cheap biscuits, I envied the whale chasers. It was then that Vanessa spoke. Her hat was pulled low over her eyes, so it was difficult for me to see her face. Mike? I turned to her. She was wearing the diamond earrings I had bought her for her 30th birthday. I know something's gone on, she said carefully. I know I've lost a bit of you, but I'm going to pretend that none of this has happened. I'm going to pretend that you and I are still okay, and that this is some kind of weird reaction to the shock that you're getting married. My heart skipped a beat. Nessa, I said, nothing happened. But she waved a hand to stop me. She looked at me, and I hated myself for the hurt in her eyes. I don't want you to explain, she said. I don't want you to feel you have to tell me anything. If you think we can be okay, that you can love me and be faithful to me, I just want us to carry on as we were. I want us to get married, forget this, and get on with our lives. The engine started up again. I felt the vibrations under my feet, and then, as the boat swung round, the wind picked up, and Lance started to say something over the PA system, so I wasn't sure if she said anything else. She turned back to the sea, pulled her collar up round her jaw. Okay, she said. And then again. Okay? Okay, I said, and stepped forward. She let me hug her. Like I said, she's a clever woman, my girlfriend. In the 5 days that remained before we travelled back to Sydney, Vanessa and I spent most of our time locked in our room. We were not engaged in the kind of liaison I suspected Kathleen and Liza imagined, but hunched over my laptop, working out how to alter the plans in a way that would satisfy her father and the venture capitalists. It was not an easy task. If we can get the USP, we can crack it, she said. I thank God that she had marketing skills. Without the water sports, the whales are the USP. We just have to work out a way of involving them that isn't going to alienate all of the whale-watching people. That means not setting up our own operation, which would be my immediate choice. There has to be some other way of making the sea creatures accessible. She had got on to the national parks and wildlife people to talk to them about the dolphins, but they had said they wouldn't encourage tourists to have greater contact with the animals than they already allowed. Perhaps something radical, some kind of platform at the mouth of the bay with an undersea viewing area. Too expensive, and the shipping people would probably object. We could build a new jetty with a restaurant on top and a viewing area below. What are you really going to see that close to land? She sucked the end of her pen. We could try to work out some radical new spa idea. Your dad didn't like the spa thing. Or we could scrap the plans altogether and find another site. I can't see a way of using the hotel in its present form without the water sports. There's just nothing else to mark it out from what's available. Not for the luxury market. Tennis, I said. Horse riding. A new site, she said. We've got 5 days to find a new waterfront site for a £130 million development. We looked at each other and started to laugh. Saying it out loud made it sound even more ridiculous than it actually was. But Vanessa Beaker wasn't her father's daughter for nothing. Within an hour of us deciding that that was the way forward, she had hit the phones with Kathleen's old phone book, and within 4 hours she had spoken to probably every land agent between Cairns and Melbourne. "Can you email me some pictures?" Between calls on my own phone, I heard the same request time and time again. Then the other questions. "Can you tell me, are the waters designated a protected area? Do you have sea mammals or other indigenous creatures that are likely to be affected by development? Would they be interested in selling? Might they be up for negotiation?" By the end of the second day, we had earmarked two possible sites. One was an existing hotel development an hour south of Brisbane. Its plus points included its own protected bay, which had been used without complaint for water sports. But it wasn't half as beautiful as Silver Bay, and the area was already thick with five-star hotels. The other, half an hour from Bundaberg, was more accessible, but almost a third again in price. "Dad's not going to like that," she said, then smiled brightly at me. "But everything's doable, right? If we try hard enough. I mean, look what we've achieved already." "You," I said fondly, pushing her hair back from her face, "are a star." "Don't you forget it," she said. Perhaps I imagined the edge to her voice. That night we made love for the first time since she had come to Silver Bay. Given our previous physical appetite for each other, I can't explain what had happened until that point, but the atmosphere had been too odd. Neither of us had felt our old confidence in the other's response. We had hidden this insecurity under declarations of exhaustion, of too much wine. We had professed ourselves riveted by our books. I had found myself oddly conscious of the hotel's thin walls. We had gone out to eat in the town and walked back slowly along the bay holding hands. The wine, the moonlight, and the fact that I might have saved Silver Bay from the fate I had almost inflicted on it conspired to smooth over the strange resistance I felt when Vanessa and I now held each other. I had nearly messed it up, I told myself, as we strolled along silently, but not quite. We would save this development, we would save the whales, and we would save our relationship. We understood new things about each other. I had been given a second chance. In my room we had left the light off and removed our clothes wordlessly, as if we had determined by telepathy that tonight was the one. We moved closer to each other, me focusing on the voluptuous beauty of Vanessa's silhouette, my mind locked only on physical sensation as we lay down on the old bed, skin on skin, her hands skillfully searching for me, her mouth emitting little gasps of pleasure. I ran my hands over her breasts, her skin. I buried my face in her hair. I remembered the scent of her, the feel of her, the familiar way her curves felt under my fingertips. And finally I plunged into her, forgetting everything, allowing myself the despairing gasp of release. And afterwards we lay quiet as something heavy and melancholy settled in the dark around us. "You okay?" I said, reaching across her for her hand. "Fine," she said after a pause. "Lovely." I stared up into the dark, listening to the waves breaking on the sand, the distant sound of a car door closing and the revving of an engine, thinking about what the core of me knew had been missing, thinking about what I had lost. We left on the Saturday. I went downstairs early and settled up with Kathleen. I paid her half in cash, guessing that would be more useful to her than credit cards. "I'll be in touch," I said. "Things are happening fast." "Really?" She looked at me steadily. "I hope so," she said. She stuffed the money into a tin under the desk without counting it. I hope that meant that in some small way she trusted me again. I felt buoyant with relief and the confidence that something good could happen. Is Liza around? I asked, when I realized she wasn't going to volunteer. She's out on Ishmael, she said. Say goodbye to her for me. I tried not to sound as awkward as I felt. I was acutely aware of Vanessa, who had come down the stairs and was now behind me. Kathleen said nothing, but shook Vanessa's hand. Goodbye, she said. I wish you luck with the wedding. There was more than one way you could interpret that, I thought, as I went upstairs for the bags, and none reflected well on me. I would have gone straight back down, but as I passed the family corridor, I heard music. Hannah was still there. She had barely spoken to me since the development had come to light, and more than anything, that child's silence had convinced me of my failure. I stood at the door and knocked. Eventually, she opened it, a burst of music filling the air behind her. I thought I'd say goodbye, I said. She didn't answer. Oh, and I came to give you this. I held out an envelope. Your wages. The pictures were very good. She glanced at it. Her voice, when she spoke, held the faintest hint of an apology. My mum says I'm not allowed to accept your money. Okay, I said, trying to look less disconcerted than I felt. Well, I'm going to leave it on the hall table, and if you really aren't allowed to take it, I hope you'll give it to a charity for the dolphins. I know you love them. I could hear Vanessa's mobile phone going off downstairs and nodded as if that were my excuse to leave. Hannah stood in the doorway studying me. Why did you lie to us, Mike? I took a step back towards her. I don't know, I said. I probably made a big mistake and I'm trying to put it right. She looked down. Grown-ups make mistakes too, I said. But I'm trying to put it right. I hope you believe me. She raised her head, and on her face I saw suddenly that she had learnt this lesson long ago, that what I had done had merely reinforced her sense of adult fallibility, of our ability to sabotage her own blameless life. We stood still for a moment, the city hotshot and the little girl. I took a breath, and then, almost as if by instinct, I held out a hand. After the longest pause, she shook it. What about your phone? She called suddenly as I paused at the top of the stairs. We've still got your phone. Keep it, I said, grateful for the chance to offer her something, anything that might redeem me in her eyes. Do something good with it, Hannah. Really? Vanessa was already waiting in the Holden. She was wearing what she had described as her travelling outfit, a suit in a non-crease fabric with a clean shirt and a cashmere cardigan at the top of her hold-all, ready for her to change into before we hit Heathrow. I had asked with some amusement whom she was intending to meet, and she had told me that just because I no longer cared about my appearance, it didn't mean she had to give up and become a slob too. I think this was aimed at my jeans, which I had taken to wearing most days. They were comfortably worn in now, and somehow putting on a suit for a flight seemed excessive. "So long, then," said Kathleen, her arms folded as she saw us to the Holden. She was a pretty different Kathleen from the one who had welcomed me 5 weeks previously. "So long," I said. I didn't try to shake her hand. Something about the steely cross of her arms told me it would be a pointless gesture. "I won't let you down, Kathleen," I said quietly, and she tipped her head back as if that was as much as she was prepared to grant me. She had told me Liza was out on Ishmael. Part of me thought that perhaps it would be for the best if I never saw her again. As she had said, what could I possibly have to say that she would want to hear? But then, as we headed down the road and past Whale Jetty, I looked in the rearview mirror. A thin blonde woman stood at the end, her silhouette clearly outlined against the glistening sea. Her hands were shoved deep in her pockets, her dog at her feet. She was watching our white car as we drove slowly but surely away down the coast road. The flight back was as much of a pleasure as a 24-hour flight ever is. We sat beside each other, bickered about correct terminals, swapped unwanted items from our trays of food, and watched several films, none of which I can remember, but I was grateful for the distraction. At some point I slept, and when I woke I was dimly aware of Vanessa going through a list of figures next to me. I was thankful again for her willingness to back me. We landed at almost 6 in the morning, but by the time we had made it through passport control it was nearly 7. Heathrow was crowded, chaotic and grey, even at that hour and at the height of what was loosely described as summer. Everyone feels bad when they get back from abroad, I told myself, rubbing at the crick in my neck as we headed for the baggage carousel. It's one of the certainties of travel, like delays and inedible airline food. Predictably, the luggage was late. An announcement in unapologetic tones revealed that because of staff shortages, there was only one team of baggage handlers for the 4 flights that had arrived in the past hour, and added, with masterly understatement, that we should expect a slight delay. "I could murder a coffee," said Vanessa. "There must be a shop somewhere." "I need to find a loo," I said. She looked exhausted, even with her carefully refreshed hair and makeup. She never slept well on flights. "The coffee shops don't start till after customs. You watch for the bags." I walked away, more swiftly than exhaustion should have allowed. Over the past month I had got used to being alone, and spending a week joined at the hip to Vanessa, working and sleeping with hardly a minute's break, had been hard. It had been made harder given that few people wanted to talk to us any more, so that socialising or sitting out with the whale chasers had been almost impossible. I had not been tempted to try. I was afraid that Greg, with his simmering volatility, would confront Vanessa with what he guessed to be true. We had survived the unspoken. I was not convinced that we could manage such equanimity if the truth were laid out in front of us. The short walk across the squeaking Heathrow linoleum was the first time I had been by myself for 8 days, and it felt like a relief. "I have done the right thing," I told myself, feeling bad about such disloyal thoughts. "I am about to do the right thing." I returned a few minutes later, my face still damp from where I had stuck it under the tap. As I drew closer, I could see that the baggage carousel was revolving. Oddly, Vanessa had not collected our luggage, although I could see it travelling its lonely, squeaking path along the conveyor belt. "You must be tired," I said, bolting for the cases. But when I turned back, hauling the cases effortfully behind me, my girlfriend did not understand the concept of travelling light, Vanessa was looking at her mobile phone. "Not your dad," I said wearily. "Not already. Couldn't he even give us time to go home and grab a shower?" I was dreading what I knew would be a confrontational meeting, even with Vanessa present, and felt I needed a short time to brace myself. "No," she said, her face uncharacteristically pale. "No. It's your phone. It's a text. From Tina." Then, thrusting the message under my nose, she walked out of the airport, leaving what remained of her baggage slowly travelling round the carousel. The next time I saw her was almost 28 hours later, when I arrived at the office for the crunch meeting with Dennis. He was on his feet, and with his restored physical mobility came a kind of mad sharpening of his energies. "What's going on, Boyo?" he kept saying, grabbing at my folder of planning letters. "What's going on?" The office had felt alien to me, the city so loud and crowded that I could not convince myself it was purely jet lag that had disorientated me. When I closed my eyes, I could see the serene horizon of Silver Bay. When I opened them, I saw grey pavements, filthy gutters, the number 141 bus belching purple fumes. And the office. Beaker Holdings, once more familiar to me than my own home, now seemed monolithic and forbidding. I hesitated outside, telling myself that jet lag had thrown me in Australia and was likely to throw me again, even in England. And then there was Dennis, and I had no chance to think of anything at all. "What's going on, then? Feeling good about your big coup? The VCs are happy boys, I can tell you, happy as pigs in the proverbial." His time immobilized had brought him extra weight, and he was oversized, florid, compared to the lean, wind-whipped figures with whom I had spent the past month. "You look like crap," he said. "Let's organize some coffee. I'll get one of the girls to go out and get us some, not that instant swill they make here." In the brief moments after he left the boardroom, I sat down next to Vanessa. She had failed resolutely to meet my eye and was now sitting in front of a blank foolscap pad. She was wearing what she called her power suit. "I'm sorry," I murmured. "It's not what it seems. Really. Meet me afterwards and I can explain." "Not what it seems," she said, doodling on the pad. "That little welcome home seemed pretty self-explanatory to me." "Nessa, please. You wouldn't answer my calls. At least give me 5 minutes. After this. 5 minutes." "Okay," she said, eventually. "Great. Thank you." I squeezed her arm, then braced myself for the task ahead. He listened carefully as I outlined what I had done while I had been out there. He and Darren, our accountant, and Ed, the head of projects, scribbled notes as I outlined my considerations with regard to the ecological impact. I told them why I had been wrong to go for the S94 option and why the planning process could still backfire on us if it went to a public inquiry, as it had with the Pearl Farm. "The upshot," I said, "is that while I think the idea of our development, the idea of its USP," here I glanced at Vanessa, "is still the right one, our existing plan is wrong for all the following reasons." I handed them the pages I had photocopied that morning, the list of alternative sites and the breakdown of incurred costs that altering our proposal would take. "We have already identified the new sites, have spoken with the local agents, and I think, having done the research, that these are by far the better options in terms of both potential adverse publicity and in terms of our new added USP, which is that of responsible community-friendly development." I gestured towards the table. "Vanessa has been out with me. She's seen these creatures in the flesh. She's seen the whale's habitat and the strength of feeling about them. She's in agreement that the best way forward for this company is either of the two alternative options. I know there will be time penalties, I know we'll have to sell the existing site, but I believe that if you were to take me along to Valence, I could swing them round to the same way of thinking." "Bloody hell," said Dennis, studying the figures. "That's some change you're proposing." He sucked his teeth, flicked through the two bottom pieces of paper. "That's going to cost almost 20% of the total budget." He had not, I noted hopefully, dismissed it all out of hand. But we lose the costs of the S-94 by building on an existing site. If you look at column 3, you'll see there is very little in the final figures. This is a less risky option, really. Less risky, eh? Dennis turned to Vanessa. Ditch the whole thing, eh? You really think we should move the whole development to this second site? She looked at him, and then she turned slowly to me. Her eyes were cold. No, she said. I've considered this carefully. I think we should go ahead with what we've got.
15. Liza.
I saw a whale today, one of the last of the season. She came right up to the boat with her calf, and they sat there starboard side in the clear blue water looking at us, as if they had nothing better to do in all the world. She was closer than she should have been, close enough for me to see each little cut of the mother's fingerprint, the pattern on her tail fluke, close enough to see the calf lie still and happy, half protected under the belly of its mother. The customers were thrilled. They squealed, took pictures and video footage, and said aloud it was an experience that had changed their lives, something they would never forget. They said they'd heard I had a way of finding the whales, and now that they'd seen it was true, they'd recommend me to all their friends. But I couldn't smile. I wanted to shout at the whale to take her baby far from here. I kept seeing that calf, washed up on the shore, covered with tarpaulin. I didn't want her to trust us like she did. I suppose I shouldn't have been shocked at what Mike had done, but I was. I'd really thought that, after everything I'd been through, I could spot someone like him a mile off. And the knowledge that I'd failed gnawed away at me, woke me up from what little sleep I ever had. It sat over me and mocked me when I woke, joined the chorus of other voices that told me much of what I had ever done was wrong. I suppose the raw anger I carried with me in those early days was directed at myself for what had been my stupidity, for allowing myself to sleepwalk us all into danger, and, perhaps, for allowing myself to think, even briefly, that my life might be allowed to take a different course from the one I have long since resigned myself to. But I was angry with pretty much everyone. With Mike for lying to us, with the planners for considering his proposal without considering the whales, with Kathleen for letting him stay on so that I'd had to live with his perfumed accomplice floating around my house, flashing her engagement ring and pretending none of it mattered, and then with Greg for, well, for being such an idiot. He was round every day, half furious with me, half wanting my forgiveness. We seemed to end up shouting at each other every time we met. I think we were both all over the place for a while, and neither of us had the energy to be kind. I don't know why. I hadn't felt like that for some time. But for several days during that first week, while Mike and his girlfriend remained in the hotel, it had been an effort to get myself out of bed. Then he had gone. And somehow, that didn't make it any better. Hannah had picked up on it. She had told me, a little defiantly, that Mike had paid her for her photographs, showed me the brown envelope packed with notes, and, before I could say a word, she had announced that she was donating the money to the national parks to help rescue stranded sea creatures. She had spoken to them, she said, and there was enough to buy another dolphin stretcher and some over. How could I refuse her? I knew there was some small part of my daughter that wanted to defend Mike, and for that, I hated him even more. She seemed low. She had stopped asking about the New Zealand trip and spent a lot of time in her room. When I asked if anything was the matter, she told me, very politely, that she was fine, in a way that let me know my presence wasn't wanted. I missed my daughter, though. At night, When she still crept into my room, I held on to her sleeping form as if I was making up for all the times in the day when she no longer chose to be near me. So, all in all, we were a disjointed household that winter. The whale chasers often stayed away in the evenings, as if sitting out together gave them too acute a sense of what might be lost. Yoshi, Lance told me, smoking furiously, was thinking of resuming her academic career. Greg's ex had finally relinquished her claim on Suzanne, but he didn't behave as if this was any great victory. I think that, having stopped scrapping with her about the boat, he had had the headspace to think about what he had lost, and introspection didn't suit him. The demolition of the Bullen place went ahead at the end of August. Overnight, wire fencing went up round it. Contractors from out of town, with their team of great yellow prehistoric machines, came and clawed it to pieces. Less than 72 hours later, the fencing was gone, and there was nothing left but a dug-out patch of disturbed earth where the old house and sheds had been. When I steered in and out of the bay, it looked like a great scar on the land, a mournful O of protest. To add to the despondent mood, the skies were unusually grey and soulless. A seaside town enveloped by grey is a place with the joy vacuumed out. Guest numbers had fallen. The local motels dropped their rates to recapture the weekend trade. We all put our heads down against the wind and tried not to think about any of it too hard. And all the while those boats kept circling. It was as if they had heard about the hotel complex and decided it was open season. Twice I was out by Breaknose Island, and those triple-deckers came thudding along the coastline full of drunks, deafening the ocean with their music. Ironically, one was describing itself in the local paper as providing all the excitement of a whale-watching trip. After I had rung the paper and told them exactly what I thought of them for carrying the advertisement, Kathleen told me baldly that if I carried on like that, I'd give myself an ulcer. She seemed oddly reconciled to our fate. Either way, since our discussion in her office that night, we didn't talk much about it. I didn't understand why she was so willing to let Mike off the hook, and she didn't enlighten me. Night after night, Kathleen lay at her end of the house, and I lay awake in my little room at the end of the corridor, listening to the sea, and wondering how long I would still be able to hear that sound before, inevitably, Hannah and I were forced to pack our bags and move on. At the start of September, the council officers announced there would be a planning inquiry, and everyone would be allowed to have their say. Few in Silver Bay held out much hope that our say would make a difference. In previous years, we had seen many such developments in and around the various bays, and 9 times in 10 they went ahead in the face of the fiercest local opposition. Given the amount of supposed benefits Mike's company was offering, I couldn't see that this inquiry would pay any more than lip service to our views. And besides, the opposition was far from straightforward. It had become an issue that divided the town. There were those who accused us whale chasers of dramatizing the whale's plight. A greater number who didn't seem to care much one way or the other. And some pointed out that what we did was an intrusion in itself. It was hard to refute that, especially when we were faced with the fact that other boats, with less rigorous codes of behaviour, increasingly treated our waters as their own. The cafe owners and boutique managers had an interest in a bigger, busier town, and while it sounds unlikely, I had some sympathy for them. We all had to earn a living, and I knew more than most that some seasons were harder than others. Then there were the whale chasers, the fishermen and those who simply enjoyed the presence of the dolphins and the whales, and others who didn't want to see our quiet bay become loud and lively, like so many places that people like us would pay good money to avoid. But it felt as if we were the quieter of the voices. It felt as if we were unlikely to be heard. The newspapers covered the debate with what seemed unhealthy relish. It was the best story they'd had since the great pub fire of 84. They withstood the accusations of bias that flew from both sides and repeatedly called on the planners, developers and council officers to justify and re-justify their position, until I guessed even they were sick of the sound of their own voices. Twice I saw Mike's name mentioned and, despite myself, read what he had said. Both times he talked about compromise. Both times I heard his voice in my head as clearly as if he'd spoken, and wondered how someone could say so much and mean so little at the same time. Let me tell you something about humpbacks. The first time I saw one, I was a child of 8. I was on holiday, out fishing with my Aunt Kathleen and my mother, who didn't like fishing, but didn't want me in the boat alone with my aunt. Her big sister Kathleen, she said jokingly, was liable to forget everything if faced with the challenge of a large fish, and she didn't want me plopping over the edge while Kathleen reeled one in. I suspect now that she had just wanted an excuse to spend time with her sister. By then, they had lived on separate continents for several years, and the distance hurt them both. I loved those holidays. I loved the sense of safety, of my own immersion within a family I had not been aware I had. I didn't have a father in England. My mother called Ray McCullen careless, and my aunt called him something a little spicier, until my mother shook her head, as if it was something that shouldn't be said in front of me. It certainly wasn't to be mentioned in front of anyone else. I was brought up by women, by my mother in England, and, when we were sent the money, by Aunt Kathleen and my grandmother in Australia. Kathleen's mother, my grandmother, was a shadowy sort, as indistinct a memory as Kathleen was a sharp one. She was the kind of woman who had no interests, who cooked and raised a family, and then, once those duties had been discharged, seemed a little lost. A woman of her time, Kathleen would say. My few memories of her stem from my 2 visits as a child, and are of a benign, distant presence in the back rooms of the hotel, lost to television soaps, or asking me questions ill-suited to my age. Kathleen, said everyone old enough to remember, was her father's daughter. She was always doing something, gutting fish, or sneaking me into the empty whale chases museum, which, to a child of 8, seemed the height of freedom. My mother, a good 15 years younger, always seemed the more mature of the two, dressed to the nines with immaculate hair and makeup. Kathleen, with her worn trousers and unbrushed hair, her salty language and her shark tails, was a revelation to me. Her godlike status was sealed on our second visit, when she took me out fishing with my mother, and we were joined by an unexpected visitor. She had been carefully explaining the different flies in her little fabric roll and attaching them to her line when, not 10 feet from us, making no sound except the gentle breaking of the waters, a huge black and white head surfaced. My breath lodged in my throat, and my heart was thumping so hard that I thought the terrifying creature would hear it.
Aunt Kathleen, I whispered.
My mother was asleep on a berth, her lipsticked mouth slightly open. I remember wondering fleetingly whether it was preferable to be asleep when you were killed so you wouldn't know what had happened.
What's that?
I honestly thought we were about to be eaten. I could see what I thought were its teeth and its huge assessing eye. I had seen the old engravings of malevolent sea creatures, had seen the broken-backed Maui II in the museum, testament to nature's fury with man. This huge creature appeared to be weighing us up, as if we were some tempting seaborne morsel. But my aunt just glanced behind her, then turned back to her bait.
That, sweetie, is just a humpback. Pay it no attention. It's just being nosy. It'll go soon enough.
She paid it no more heed than a seagull. And, sure enough, some minutes later, the huge head slid back beneath the waves, and the whale was gone. And this is what I love about them. Despite their might, their muscular power, their fearsome appearance, they are among the most benign creatures. They come to look, and then they go. If they don't like you, their signals are pretty clear. If they think the dolphins are getting a little too much attention from our passengers, they will occasionally come partway into the bay and jealously divert them. There is often a childlike element to their behaviour, a mischievousness. It is as if they cannot resist discovering what's going on. Many years ago, the early whalers referred to humpbacks as the merry whale for the way they performed. And when I began working the boat trips 5 years ago, I discovered the nickname held true. One day, I would call up the other whale chasers on the radio and find a whale swimming upside down on the surface, one flipper waving. The next, I would come across one launching fully out of the water with a 360-degree breach, like an oversized ballerina, pirouetting for the sheer joy of it. I'm pretty sure I could never be described as merry, but Kathleen once told me she suspected I felt such a bond with the whales because they are solitary creatures. There is no male-female bond, not a lasting one anyway. The male plays no parenting role to speak of. She didn't add that the females are not monogamous. By then she hardly needed to. But they are admirable mothers. I have seen a humpback risk beaching itself to nudge her baby into deeper water. I have heard the songs of love and loss breaking into the silence of the deepest parts of the ocean. And I have cried with them. In those songs, you hear all the joy and pain of any mother's happiness held captive by their baby's heart. After Letty died, there was a period when I thought I would never be happy again. There is nothing redemptive about the loss of a child. No lessons of value it can teach you. It is too big, too overwhelming, too black to articulate. It is a bleak, overwhelming physical pain, shocking in its intensity. And every time you think you might have moved forward an inch, it swells back like a tidal wave to drown you again. If you can blame yourself for that child's death, the days when you can get your head above water are even fewer. I had trouble in those early days, remembering that I had two daughters. I can thank Hannah for my existence now, but in the weeks after we got here, I was so lost that I had nothing to give her. No reassurance, no physical comfort, no love. I was locked somewhere untouchable, my nerve endings seared with pain, and it was a place so ugly, I half think I wanted to protect her from coming too close. That was when I saw the sea as my one opportunity for release. I eyed it not as a thing of beauty, of reassuring permanence, but as an alcoholic views a secret stash of whiskey, savouring the fact that it was there and the potential for relief that it promised. Because there was no relief from Letty's absence, not from the moment I woke or during my disjointed nightmare-filled sleep. I felt her resting against me, smelt the honey scent of her hair, and woke screaming when I realised the truth of where she lay. I heard her voice in the silence. My head echoed with the last wrenching screams of our separation. There was a hole in my arms where her weight should have been, which, despite the presence of my other daughter, grew into an abyss. Kathleen is no fool. She must have guessed my intentions when I expressed interest in that boat. My depression insulated me from the idea that I might be transparent. One afternoon, when the two of us dropped anchor round the heads, she secured Ishmael, turned away and said with a bite in her voice, "Go on, then." I had stared at her back. It was a bright afternoon, and I remember thinking absently that she wasn't wearing sun cream. "Go on what?"
"Jump. That's what you're planning, isn't it?"
I had thought I was numb to feeling, but it was as if she had kicked me in the stomach. She turned and fixed me with a gimlet stare.
You'll excuse me if I don't look. I don't want to have to lie to your daughter about what happened to her mother. If I don't look, I can pretend you fell overboard.
I let out a coughing sound then. Air kept expelling itself in little gasps from my chest, and I couldn't speak.
That little girl has been through too much,
Kathleen continued.
If she knows you didn't love her enough to stay here for her, it will finish her off. So, if you're going to do it now while my back's turned. I don't want to spend the next 6 months living on my nerves, wondering how I'm going to protect her from it.
I found myself shaking my head. I couldn't speak, but my head moved slowly from side to side, as if I was telling her, telling myself even, that I wasn't going to do what she had predicted, that somehow I was making a decision to live. And even as my body made that decision for me, some small part of my mind was thinking, but how do I live? How is it possible to exist with so much pain? For a moment, the prospect of having to go on with all that inside me seemed overwhelming. It was then that we saw them. 7 whales, their bodies slick with seawater as they rose and fell around Kathleen's boat. There was a kind of graceful rhythm to their movements, a flowing continuity that told us of their journey. After circling the boat, they dived. Each emerged briefly, then vanished below the waves. As a spectacle, then, it diverted me from the most despairing thoughts I have ever had. But later, when we returned home and I took my poor, living, grieving child in my arms, I saw that, although I was sceptical about signs, there had been a message in what I had seen. It was to do with life, death, and cycles, the insignificance of things, perhaps the knowledge that everything will pass. One day, I will be reunited with my Letty again, although I no longer expect to choose when that will be. If there is a God, Hannah tells me sometimes, when we are alone in the dark, he will understand. He will know that I am a good person. And I hold my daughter close to me, and think that possibly, just possibly, her mere existence is proof that that might be true. Since that day on the boat, I have never had a problem with finding the humpbacks. Kathleen always said I could smell them, and, odd as it sounded, there was some truth in it. I just seemed to know where they were. I followed my nose, and although it often seemed an impossibility, staring at those waves in the hope that one would metamorphose into a nose or a fin, 9 times out of 10 they would show for me. But towards the end of that winter, something odd happened. At first, it was the slapping. When a whale is sending a warning, either to humans or other whales, it engages in the peduncle slap, thrashing the water with the flukes of its tail, or, occasionally, just slapping the surface, its tail flat side down, sending out a noise that reverberates for miles. We don't see it often. We try not to upset the whales. But suddenly, I seemed to see it in all of the few that surfaced. Then, at least 2 weeks earlier than they should have done, according to migration patterns, they disappeared. Perhaps it was the extra boat traffic. Perhaps they had sensed somehow that things were changing and chose not to grace us with their presence. Either way, those of us who operated off Whale Jetty gradually found it harder to locate them, even at a time when they should have been surfacing at a rate of 2 or 3 a trip. At first, we hardly liked to admit it to each other. It was a mark of honour to be able to find the whales, and only those like Mitchell Dre hung off everyone else's coattails. When we got talking, each of us discovered that our experience was not unique. By mid-September, things had got so bad that both the Mobys switched temporarily to dolphin trips round the bay. It was less lucrative, but it meant less disappointment for the customers and, more importantly, fewer refunds. Then the dolphins seemed to disappear too. There were so few some days that we knew them by sight and were conscious of the risk of harassing them. As we headed for October, I was the only boat still going out every day, more in hope than expectation. The seas, dark and swaying around me, seemed alien, even on the brighter days. I felt the whale's absence, as I felt the absence of all those things I've loved. I couldn't believe so many sea creatures would just leave us, that they would change the behaviour of centuries at whim. And, grieved by the past week's events, perhaps a little unhinged by loss, I found myself yelling at them one day when I had gone out alone. I stood holding the wheel, my voice bouncing off the waves, ignored by the creatures who perhaps swam beneath me, hiding themselves from an increasingly unfriendly world. "What the hell am I meant to do?" I shouted, until Millie stood up on the bridge and whined with uneasiness. But I knew that somehow it was my fault, that I had failed the creatures of the sea as I had failed my children. And my question disappeared, caught and carried away on the wind. What the hell am I meant to do? At 4 p.m. on the last Thursday in September, John rang to say Mr. Gaines had suffered a heart attack. My Aunt Kathleen was a tough woman. They didn't call her Shark Lady for nothing. It was the first time I had ever seen her cry.
16. Mike. Monica's guest bedroom was a guest bedroom in only the loosest of senses. It was not remotely geared up for guests, and was a bedroom only in that, along with the 14 cardboard boxes, 2 electric guitars, a mountain bike, 49 pairs of shoes, a 1960s pine chest of drawers, framed posters of various rock groups I had never heard of, and my childhood train set, it contained a camp bed. "I'll clear you a space," she had promised, when I had concluded that it made no financial sense for me to stay long-term in a hotel, and had tentatively mentioned moving in. But in Monica's world, that didn't mean clearing some boxes or even transferring the bike to the communal hallway, but instead shifting a bin bag or two of clothes so that there was room, just about, for the camp bed to open out on the floor. There I lay, night after night, the springs digging through the foam mattress into my back, the leathery scent of my sister's old shoes permeating the dusty room, as, like some penitent, I considered the mess I had made of what had seemed at the time a rather